This is Sci-Fi Tech Talk.
Welcome to Sci-Fi Tech Talk, the podcast where we explore the technology of sci-fi. I'm Mike McPeak, and with me today is Jeff Sire.
Hello, everyone.
And Julie couldn't be here. Various personal issues arose to stop her from being on the podcast. But we do have a special guest tonight. We have J.F. Dubow. Why don't you tell the people a little bit about yourself before we get into the meat of the podcast here?
Wow, I'm starting super professional here with the ums and the uhs and the stuttering. This is great. This is good radio, good podcasting. My name is J.F. Dubow. I'm professionally a graphic designer and brand specialist. I'm trying to be something else because being a brand specialist in my particular geographic area is kind of a pain in the ass. It's a good gig. It can be super fun, but anyways, I found something cooler, which I think we're going to discuss tonight.
Yeah, reading Julie's synopsis here, like we usually do for the podcast, it's really short and to the point. She said J.F. Dubow wrote a book, and that book would be The Life Engineered. I found it really interesting, but do you want to give a short synopsis for, so that people kind of know what we're talking about here? I mean, go out and read the book, people, but for the podcast, you want to give a short something here to get us up to speed.
Right. So I'm terrible at giving a synopsis because every time I try to give a synopsis, I stumble on things that I think are spoilers. But I'll do my best. Basically, it's a book that's set in the far future where the human race has kind of disappeared for some reason. There's been some apocalyptic event and they've gone into hiding on a galaxy-wide scale. And the robots that they left to replace them, which are sentient creatures, not the, like, I don't know how to love type of robots, but robots that actually have advanced, you know, emotional, complicated, complex psychological profiles, are left behind. And they've kind of built like this sort of utopic, bizarre society for themselves where nothing much happens because when you're in a post-scarcity situation, like utopia sort of ensues. Except at some point at the beginning of the story, one of them, their members gets murdered, which is sort of unheard of. And it starts pushing their society and civilization slowly towards a potential civil war. Which would be on a galactic scale and would be absolutely all-encompassing. So the main character is trying to figure out why this is happening and put a stop to it.
So basically creatures created by humans eventually start to become sort of human-like in their behavior?
The way I've designed the world is that the creatures are constructed already sentient, already self-aware. The story, it's not a spoiler to say that it's the sort of the third generation of artificially created life forms that humans have at their disposal in history at that point in the game.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for me not to, talk about this without spoiling it. I'll try not to because, like I say, it's kind of an interesting book. You need to just sit down and read it. But now the personalities how do you pronounce this? I've been calling it K-Pek in my head.
When I was writing the book, I was calling him K-Pek 2, and at some point I was talking with, I think it was James Bartholomew from Initiative Check podcast. I was asking him about voiceover information, and he told me it was pronounced Chepek, because it's a Czechoslovakian name taken from Karel Chepek, who is the first person to have coined the term robot.
Okay. Well, I've noticed in here that you made different references to different cultures, even some, religious connotations, more of the reincarnation stuff. Did you take influences from the world around you to kind of start to create your story?
Well, the way I created the story was essentially I wanted to sort of extrapolate what our future as human beings would be, especially as regarding to artificial intelligence. So one of the key themes of how I built the world was basically how would I like to see artificial intelligence, robotics be used in the future, like in the far future, not in 10 years, 20 years as having Robbie the robot serve me martinis in my hot tub, but more in what happens once we start colonizing other planets, what happens once they start being conversant and understanding us and having their own ambitions. And that led me to the line of thought that it would be a lot cooler to be a robot than to be a human being. Because one of the themes that's sort of, I wouldn't say explored, because there's not much to, you know, there's not much to extrapolate from it. But the whole point is that these robots are created mind first, body second, so that they can decide, well, this is what I want to do with my 2,000, 3,000 life existence, and I'm going to design a body that's perfectly suited to do it.
Well, yeah, I found that idea kind of interesting. Now, were these consciousnesses lived in the nursery where they're, like you say, their mind is developed first. Now, were those human consciences or were they computer, not generated, but were they artificially created and then they just sat there and relived their lives? That's kind of the reincarnation part. It seemed like they lived their lives over and over again until they reached the, I think at some point you said they reached the state of nirvana when they could transcend from the nursery and then actually get a body and go out into the world.
Right. The entire point of that is, and I've sort of decided in the background whether or not they are human consciousness that are translated to the digital world, or if they're just artificial constructs just reliving lives. I've got that in the back of my mind, and I'm not necessarily ready to reveal it yet. That's going to be something in a subsequent book. But the idea is that if you're going to allow an artificial creature, an artificial consciousness, to build itself its own body, which could potentially have any means of destruction and transportation, could do almost anything with that level of technology, would you want that consciousness to be as stable as possible? So I kind of went back to the idea of Buddhism and inner balance and inner peace. And the idea of reincarnating might not be something that's, if you're a skeptic or an atheist, isn't something that you believe in the real world, but in a sort of artificial reality or virtual reality, it is totally something that you could do. You could take a core consciousness and have it live through a variety, like hundreds and hundreds of lives, until that core consciousness reaches a point where it's completely balanced on a moral and ethical level. And at that point, then you can pull it out of this what I call a nursery, this artificial environment, and give it form, give it a body, so that it can start interacting and contributing to galactic civilization.
Yeah, in theory, you should have had, if people have reached, or these consciousnesses have reached the correct level, you should have what one would hope would be a perfect society. But you start to see cracks in here. Even at the very beginning of the books, even the humans, before they disappeared, they had concerns about would their caretakers finally get to the point where they figured that they didn't need the humans. So you do start to see cracks in what should be an otherwise well-developed society.
Yeah, but unfortunately, and that's one of the problems with writing anything that has to do with perfection, or it's one of the things that I've always let me go on a small tangent. One of the characters I've always found would be the hardest to write for would be Superman, because when you have characters that are perfect or that can solve any problem with a blink of an eye, or any like deus ex machina that they pull out of their derriere, it becomes really hard to have a story. So you need that element, you need that crack in the system to be able to pull a story out of.
Yeah, Jeff's got a bit of a Skype lag going on here, and we had enough fun trying to get this call connected. More error on my part than I think to technology's part. But he did have he's a
relay. I wouldn't be so quick not to blame Skype.
Well, that's an easy fix.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was hoping that things would work tonight, because if we had to sacrifice a virgin to the Skype gods, it might be a little hard in this town. But he did want to know, how long did it take you to write the book?
The book took pretty much start to finish until the point where I was where I did the initial release on the book. It took almost a year day to day. I wrote a quick first draft, and then it took me about maybe a month, no, about 3 months to actually forge it into something I was ready to release onto some beta readers. And those guys took another 2 months to come back to me with comments, a lot of comments. I'm fortunate enough that one of my beta readers is a developmental editor and not one that's willing to spare my feelings if it's going to cost the story. So I got some really good professional guidance as to how to fix the book to be okay. And then from there, it took like maybe another 6 months to just do rewrite after rewrite until I got it to a point where I felt comfortable enough to publish it. But also, I mean, like any work of art, you can keep going back to it and making it better and better, but then it never sees the light of day and you just stagnate in the same piece. I wanted to move on. So I was satisfied with it after a year and decided to put it out.
Well, was this a story that seemed to flow naturally? I mean, did it just kind of come to you, or was it something that you really kind of had to sit down and kind of massage things to get the story to work?
I would say it's a bit of both, actually. One of the things that happened, a lot of the core ideas for the technology in the story came from a webcomic I was trying to put together almost a decade ago. So the whole idea of having robots that come personality first and body second comes from that sort of personal research and that fascination with robotics I had almost a decade ago. The story itself is a more recent thing, and that only happened maybe a year and a half ago when I started writing the first draft. So it's really a mix of old and new a new story idea, but really based on an older, more mature foundation.
Yeah, I got, as I was reading this, I kind of, you know, quite often people think of Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics. And at one point in here, again, I'm trying not to spoil it too much, but one of the characters, for the greater good, basically commits suicide. Did any of those robotic laws, because one of them is, you know, to do no harm to itself, but, you know, did any of that enter in while you were writing this?
Well, one of the things I tried to do is look beyond robots as programs and have them have more of an organic personality. So while it is one of the themes in the book, and it's actually one of the potential outrages of in the story, the idea of having implemented rules and algorithms that force personalities in a certain direction or another, as the Chapek see that kind of as an impediment on their freedom. So it's although I'm well aware and I love the idea of the three rules of robotics, I find that these three rules would probably be sort of a transient, temporary addition to artificial sentience, something we put in as a safeguard until we feel comfortable enough and we're socially adapted enough to having this sort of second race of thinking creatures with us.
Yeah, because like I say, at the beginning of the book, I noticed that the humans are one of the, because we only, yeah, there was what, basically, well, two humans in the book and then a construct, I guess you would call her. She seemed to have a human form in the nursery, but, you know, otherwise she was just a construct, I guess. But
just to make it clear to the listeners, right. I wrote it, you read it, so we understand the idea. I just want to sort of outline like the first three chapters. It's a bit of a spoiler, sure, but it doesn't remove from the enjoyment of the rest of the book. Is the prologue happens maybe 1,000 years before the main storyline does, and that's when you have the only two humans that you'll see in the entire book. The first chapter happens entirely in a, for lack of a better word, Matrix-like environment where the main character is portrayed as a human because that's what she thinks she is. And it's only at the third chapter that it's sort of revealed, if you will, that she's a robot, an artificial creation, and that's when we start like exploring the world in which she is. sorry, go ahead with your question. I just didn't want to the right. listeners who haven't read the book to be confused.
Yeah, and you know, to be honest, it did take me to like the third chapter, for all this to kind of fall into place. And you know, any book should do that, make you want to keep reading, you know, and find out what's going on there. But yeah, I mean, even the people at the beginning had some underlying mistrust, and so it doesn't spoil too much. They were going to build some safeguards in. They didn't say what that is. And apparently, I got the gist of it that the one lady was going to basically lay down her life to make sure that this gets done. So, but I mean, you know, even in that advanced society, they may have created these things, but they still didn't quite fully trust them. I guess they were kind of afraid. What if they do reach that level of consciousness that, why do we need these silly meat bags around? Not their words, but my words. Why do we need these silly meat bags around?
Well, I don't know how bad my lag is, but is the human consciousness used as like a seed in the nursery, and then it's built up from there? Is that was that the idea?
Well, like I was telling Mike earlier, I've sort of decided that for myself, but I'm not ready to reveal exactly where the consciousness come from that are in the certain nursery at the start of the cycle of birth and death that they go through.
Cool.
And to be
I
honest,
have another question.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, I'm making it sound very dramatic, like, oh, I'm keeping that secret under my vest. I'm not even sure it's going to have that much of any importance. It's just I don't want to reveal it because, you know, in case I want to make it a plot point in the future.
So you have reached a decision yet. You're just not revealing it then.
Exactly. Okay, and right. it might not even be important.
Okay. Jeff, you had another?
Did you intend that that the kind of, I don't know if it's a theme or whatever, but the idea that utopia leads to stagnation, did you intend that as like kind of a underlying idea?
I didn't intend it because I personally don't believe it. I think utopia is actually doesn't necessarily lead to stagnation. I think it actually can accelerate progress if it's the right kind of utopia. But right. it does seem that that's how I do portray the book. And in a way, that particular type of utopia, the civilization I portray, would have a certain level of stagnation because of the type of personalities that are being pulled from the nursery. The type of robots that are being built aren't inventors. They're not. I mean, some of them are artistic and some of them are progress oriented, but most of them are not philosophers, and they do have a purpose. They are rebuilding ecospheres and planets for the return of humanity, so they have that purpose, and until that's reached, they're not necessarily looking inwards as to how to improve their own civilization.
Okay. Yeah, you know, like I say, we have tech in our name, and every once in a while we talk about it. And you did have some interesting tech in there. And, you know, some of this I'm not, you know, completely familiar with, like the I'm probably going to butcher this name, but the Al-Kubierre drive.
An Al-Kubierre drive. It's that's actually I don't want to say recent. I don't know the entire history, but this is something that's been coming up in the news a bit more in the past year, coincidentally. And whenever you hear news of NASA. Recently, they've been working on this electromagnetic drive, and there's some news that they've noticed that it could possibly maybe be warping space around it. The NASA's also revealed some concept art, you know, just for fun, of what they think a warp ship would look like, and these things touch each other and all relate to what an Al-Kubierre drive is, and. An Al-Kubierre drive is the simple, like, layman's term is it basically creates a bubble of reality, and it compresses. I'm trying to remember. It compresses the space in front of the bubble and expands it in the back, pushing the bubble forward. And what's exciting about that is that since it's a bubble of its own reality, the ship within doesn't move. And if the ship within doesn't move, that means that the entire bubble can move faster than light without having any of the relativistic backlash that comes with moving at the speed of light.
See, that's why I'm a broom pusher, because I understand in concept what you said, but it just makes my head hurt trying to understand it. That's why people get paid the big bucks to understand this stuff.
Well, it's
sort of like creating a hole in front of you that you're falling forward to.
Exactly, or if you think of it as a wave that you'd be surfing, where you have a lot of water behind that's pushing and just emptiness in front that's, I wouldn't say pulling in this case, but...
Well, is this faster than light travel or not?
Well, what it does is opens the possibility of faster than light travel, because what's in this space-time bubble is immobile for all intents and purposes. If it's immobile, it doesn't suffer from the side effects of going faster than light.
Okay, because the ship may be immobile, but I mean you have people inside there. I mean, yeah, I start to think about this, and I probably go off in the wrong directions, and it does make my head hurt. But yeah, so basically, this is a way to transverse long distances in a short period of time. Then
exactly.
Okay.
There's basically three faster than life travel methods that I put in the book, mostly because each of them is different in its own way and can be used in different plot, in different narrative manners. There's the whole Al-Kabir drive, which is just simple movement to how you see in most sci-fi movie, going from point A to point B while moving. I use wormholes because they're super convenient, but I can... they're kind of like subway tunnels, if you will, in space. They can be faster than light, but they only move from specific point to specific points. And the last method is space folding, which is pretty much the equivalent of teleportation, but in the way I've built in the universe, it's such a dramatic way of traveling that it's not something that you necessarily want to do anytime, anywhere, and the energy requirements are astronomical, so it can't be done too much.
Okay. Because if you have something that's too convenient in a story, then it kind of breaks the story apart. But yeah, so, and I do know that because they could feel like the waves coming from the, that space folding. So it was one of those things you could anticipate a little bit ahead of.
Exactly.
Right.
The way that space folding is like I'm not a physicist or an astrophysicist of any kind. I have very layman's conceptual understanding of these things. I can wrap my mind around the concept of an Al-Kabir drive. I can wrap my mind around the concept of a wormhole. Space folding is something that keeps being brought up in movies, but the science behind it, I don't think even exists at any point. So the way I describe the space fold is I try to put in a lot of impossible things, like sound traveling through a vacuum, gravity appearing out of nowhere, and all these weird things to make it seem as out there as possible, just so it sounds cooler because I am allowed to do that.
Well, yeah, it's your world. You can kind of set the rules there.
True, but I don't want it to be fantasy either.
Well,
but...
no, this is true. Well, and then, something else we had on here was a von Neumann device. I think, is that a self-replicating device?
Well, the term von Neumann is usually attributed to self-replicated devices, but networked self-replicated devices. In the book, von Neumann is a reference to a class of Chapeks, because Chapeks are divided in different classes, not as in caste or by a hierarchy, but by different types and what their purposes and forms are. And von Neumann type Chapeks are essentially Chapeks with single consciousness, but divided within multiple bodies. And one of the main characters, which turns out to be like a huge fan favorite, a lot of people who read the book say that it's their favorite character, even though it's the hardest to write for reasons in the book that you discover. He's got a very difficult to write for speech pattern.
Yeah, I noticed it was sort of, I stumbled over it a bit, and I understand where you were going, because probably more concerned about the process than probably verbal communication. I'm terrible at taking notes. What was the name of the one craft that they were flying in the belly of?
Skinfaxi,
yes.
Which is named after Norse god.
Okay. Well, and to be honest, when I was reading the book, okay, now a personal admission here. I've been playing Borderlands way too much, and there is a little
I'm not sure. Is there too much Borderland?
Well, I don't know. At some point when I it's 3:30 in the morning, I need to go to bed. Yeah. True. But they have the little clap traps in there, so I kind of heard the clap trap voice as I can't remember.
For Skinfaxi?
Skinfaxi, yeah.
This is one of the things that I'm, like, this is the first book that I've got multiple people reading, like a lot of people reading, as opposed, I've written 5 books so far. It's the first one I'm trying to actively publish, and the first one I have a lot of strangers giving me feedback on. And this is the thing that's the most fascinating, is when people come back to me with their impression of how a character sounds or looks or behaves, and how it contrasts with how I see it. And that is so different.
Well, because he has, if I remember correctly, like I said, a lot of characters, and they start to blend together in my head. But yeah, he just sort of seemed to have that kind of smart-ass personality to him.
Yeah, his speech pattern might be not dissimilar to Claptrap, because it's a very easygoing character. His class of Chepeks, the Sputniks, are basically just living ships. So they have a level of freedom that no one's ever experienced in history before. They can go and be anywhere, and just they just swim the vacuum, which just sounds super cool when you think about it. So he's got this very easygoing demeanor, but I always pictured him as having a relatively deep voice. And Claptrap definitely does not have a deep voice.
No, he's got a squeaky voice. But for some reason, it was just – and I think it was kind of that like I say, the smart aleck attitude, I think, is probably what I saw in there. And then once I saw that, then I started hearing that voice. So,
which is fine. I mean, that's what's great about books in general, as opposed to other mediums. I'm not putting down any other mediums, but what's great about a book is that it allows you to be the casting director, the director, the special effects specialist. You get to be the entire movie crew of creating that movie in your mind, and I freaking love it.
Well, yeah, and that's what I always liked about books is, yeah, you can create them in your mind. And, you know, sometimes you go to see the movie. Sometimes the movie exceeds your expectations, but sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, that's a...
Well, one thing I've started doing, which has served me well as far as movies go, is if a movie's based on a book and I haven't read the book yet, like The Martian is a good example. Andy Weir's The Martian, which is coming out at some point with Matt Damon, looks amazing. I haven't read the book yet, and I was going to read the book until I saw the movie was announced, but I'm holding back because I want to see the movie first and then read the book. Because if the movie's any good, I'm going to walk out of there going, man, I want more of this. And usually you have more material in a book than you do on a movie.
Right.
So that's the best way for me to enjoy to enjoy a movie a second time in more detail. That's what happened when because I saw the Harry Potter movies before I read the books. And reading books was like delving into like an extended universe of the movie. It was awesome.
Well,
you rarely hear people complain the other way around, where, you know, people always complain, oh, they didn't include this that was in the book, or they didn't include that, or they did this differently. You very rarely hear people who see the movie and then read the books and say, oh, I didn't like that. It wasn't like the movie. You
exactly
don't very often hear that.
The comment you get most of the time is, oh, there's so much more in the book, and they're glad to have read the book at that point. So it's a much more positive experience.
Since you haven't read the book, I won't spoil it, but as I was reading the book, I kind of decided what his theme song was going to be. We'll have to see how the movie does it.
Like, are you talking about The Martian?
The Martian, yes.
Yeah.
So we'll see how the movie treats it. But back to this tech thing that we do. The other thing you had in there was consciousness transference. And I don't know if that's the same thing, but the nursery, I guess the people, did they take the whole body and soul and everything and put them into the nursery, or to the, not the nursery, the, where the humans were stored?
Yeah, that would be the nursery. Are you talking about the humans that become Chupacs or the humans later in the book?
The ones that are basically put away for safekeeping.
Okay, well, those guys are basically in a ship in some kind of stasis, undefined suspended animation at this point.
Okay.
So without revealing too much, I mean, you don't necessarily see what they're doing in that ship and what's happening in that ship once it's revealed. So
well, yeah, like I say, you didn't reveal that. I was just kind of curious, but I guess in the case of the Chupacs, yeah, okay.
No, you can call them Capex. Like that's how I keep calling them myself. Is just right. I was taught what the proper pronunciation was. Now I'm conflicted.
Well, yeah, because I was reading, and I had nothing to go on, so I was going Capex. So
it's one of the funny things about learning things by reading about them and then being confronted with the reality of the spoken word.
Well, yeah, and I don't do language real well sometimes. So a lot of those names in there, and when I see a name, and especially in science fiction, because they'll trot out some really interesting ones, in my mind, basically I'm hearing, whatever. But it's just, I see the words, and I know, okay, this is that character. But as far as anything verbal attached to that, no, I just, if it's too hard, I don't try to do the pronunciation. I just make it.
That is one of my – if I have one regret is delving too deep into the Mesoamerican names for some of the characters because those are so hard to pronounce.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you that one right there because, it's just kind of like was it Mayans, Incas? Some of those with the X's and the and that stuff, and it's like
and just apostrophes everywhere.
Yes,
I mean they're fun names, and I guess when you're reading, it's not too bad. But then when you want to discuss a character, or anytime you want to bring it up verbally, it's a tongue twister every time. Fortunately, I kept that to secondary character, and I'll be more careful in the future.
Well, like I say, I've read enough science fiction. This isn't new to me, but yeah, it's that's just my personal weaknesses. When I'm reading stuff, I just don't always put names sounds to names. So
it's probably
it's difficult to keep characters straight if you can't actually kind of think about the name in your head. If it's just like a kind of a jumble of letters, like with the Mesoamerican names.
Well, I think the one thing I did correctly is choose names that don't look the same on the page,
right?
That don't have the same vowel to consonant composition, so they don't they're at least visually easy to recognize. But yeah, I'm working on the sequel, and I'm not steering clear of Mesoamerican names, but the ones I do select are easier to pronounce, or I'll throw in a nickname given by other characters and things like that. Because that's another thing that's maybe not explained correctly in the book is that the characters don't always communicate verbally, or very, very seldom communicate verbally, being that they're in a vacuum and all. They communicate by just data transfer.
It's certainly very easy to differentiate between the characters between their groups, just simply because of their names, because the names are so different. Like you have the Norse names, the Mesoamerican names, and then the Roman ones, like from the different nurseries.
Right, the way they keep their lineage. I'm not even sure why I started doing that, except that I needed names, and then it became a sort of a way, an interesting background element to the story. And now I'm super attached to it.
Well, I did find it kind of interesting that, you did have them. There seemed to be lineages going on there, which seems kind of like a human-type trait. For being, they are artificial intelligences, basically, very refined ones, but they did seem to have some human characteristics. Like they referred to their – you had the Gaeas, which are basically the mother planets? No, not planets. What would you call them?
They're basically they're their own class of Chupacs, in the sense that instead of being ships or you know, bipeds or whatever, they're essentially giant factories varying in size, but usually rather large, and they build the other capex, and they're I'm doing it too. they build the other capex, and they're the most complex ones of their species, and they're usually their names will reflect their role. Like they'll usually have the names of fertility goddesses and things like that, because that's what they do. They create life.
Yeah, and but then, you know, they often referred to their creations as you know, sons or daughters, and in a world full of, you know, well, I don't want to say robots, but I mean mechanical beings is called the idea of he's and she's. I guess they self-identified when they came out of the nursery. They kind of picked what they wanted to be.
It's a funny thing about the story. Like, the main character identifies as female for reasons that become kind of important in the book. But most of the characters, some of them will have a gender identification that's mostly derived from their name, but being that they don't have any of the biological gender differentiations, like they don't have the bits and pieces, they don't have the hormones, they don't have any of the visual cues that separate men from women. So although the names will sometimes have a gender attached to it, most of the characters don't really do the gender thing. So it's interesting. I'm actually exploring that a lot in the second book, is the difference between the characters that do play the gender game and those that don't.
Well, yeah, and you know, I'm thinking here too about somewhere in the book there. Again, I'm trying to tap dance around the spoilers. At some point, they want to.
Can I make a suggestion? Like, and this is your podcast, so like, shoot me down if you want. What we can do, if you want to go into spoilers, we can talk until a certain point, and then I'll give the information where to get the book.
Okay.
And then we can kick Jeff out if he doesn't want to hear any spoilers, and you and I can do like 10-15 minutes about spoilers with the proper warning, so that people who have read the book can sort of get more to bite on.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. We've never done that before, but we could try that, because Mount Julie's not here to boss us around. So
that's right. The cat's away. The mice will dance.
Okay, all right. Because it's an idea.
You're gonna kill me.
Yeah, because there's certain things in there that I'm, you know, kind of interested in talking about, but I don't want to spoil it for people. So that's an idea. At some point, when we feel that we've done our overview good enough, and do you want to stick around, Jeff? Do you want to be spoiled, or do you want to go read the book?
Spoilers have no effect on me. I am totally fine with all spoilers.
Okay. So I think when we reach that point, we'll put out a big warning here that, you know, if you do not want to be spoiled, please leave now. With all your proper information. So I'm trying to think, what else is there we want to discuss before we actually, you know, spoil it like week-old milk?
If you guys don't want to talk about the book anymore, I can talk about Inkshares and the publishing history behind the book. That's not interesting as far as the history, but where it could go. And I'm not just going to do this to like sell my book, but just to sell the idea of Inkshares in general, because I think it's a very exciting thing. If you're into literature, if you're into sci-fi, and you've kept your eye on the self-publishing genre, I think you'll find what Inkshare has to offer very interesting.
Yeah, I heard you talking about it on Sci-Fi Geeks Club, and the idea seemed...
Ugh, those guys. I mean, what? Sorry,
yeah,
Dave.
Somebody I heard of. So the idea sounded kind of interesting. Can you explain it briefly, or...?
So I'll explain like my whole history with Inkshares, and you guys you'll see why I think it's exciting, whether or not it works for me. Here's the thing: Inkshares is actually. Let me start over. You guys all know about crowdfunding, right? You know the Kickstarters, you know the Indiegogo, and you know the Patreon more recently. And these are all awesome, except that they have one ginormous flaw when it comes to artists in general and writers in particular, is that if you do a crowdfunding campaign and it's successful, they cut you a check and send you on your way. And as a writer, you've solved none of your problems except cash flow. which means that you still need to find an editor, you still need to find distribution, you still need to find someone to do your cover. You basically, you have a laundry list of tasks, and none of them are writing my book. So it's a huge annoyance. And while Kickstarter and Indiegogo are great for certain things, for publishing, they're not as good. And there has been, and there still are, crowdfunding platforms specifically for writers, like PubSlush, but they basically follow the same format. It's like, you've got your goal, here's your money, we take our share, goodbye. Inkshares is different in the sense that what it does is you do a campaign, and instead of trying to reach a financial goal, they set your financial goal for you based on a certain quantity of books that people need to pre-order. So if you're trying to do just digital, it's 750 books. If you're trying to do physical books, it's 1,000 books. And the goal you're trying to reach is to get published. Once you reach that goal, instead of them just cutting you a check, they'll give you your share of the pre-order money, because you know it's kind of royalty based, and the royalties are on par with what you'll see from, say, Kindle or Amazon and most of the other platforms. I think they're actually better than iBooks. Anyways, so they'll cut you a share of your pre-orders, but then they take over the publication aspect. If you need it, they'll assign you to a developmental editor. They'll have someone proofread the book. They'll find someone to do the cover, and basically they'll do what a publisher does. So their entire thing is to, you create a book, you find a public for it, and then once you've secured that public, they'll publish it.
So you do the creation, you kind of get the interest, and then they'll handle the back end of it, of the publishing and distribution, and so you don't have to worry about that end so much?
Exactly. So you don't have to worry about it any more than you would with a normal publisher. So it's kind of a hybrid between a standard crowdfunding platform, a standard publisher, and a vanity press, in the sense that you're the one going to them, but before they'll publish you, you need to prove that your project has worth. So you can't just pay them to publish you. You'd be better off going to a vanity press if you want to do that. So that's what's interesting for Inkshare itself. Now, what makes it cooler is that Inkshare's currently has a partnership with the Sword and Laser Book Club and Community and Podcast, where they're doing this contest for science fiction fantasy writers. The contest is the whole thing is that Inkshare is a very young platform. I think they started in April 2014. I was chatting with their CEO earlier last month, and he was giving me a bit of the history. And they're right now, what they're doing is they're trying to get as many people on the Inkshare platform to know what it is. Because the same thing for Patreon and Kickstarter, you can have as many projects as you want. If no one knows that your platform exists, you don't get contributors. You don't get people to back projects. And that's the kind of critical mass you want to reach, where people seek out the projects like they do on Kickstarter. So they've got this deal or association or partnership with Sword and Laser. And Sword and Laser is doing this contest where the top five books in sci-fi and fantasy that have the most pre-order by May 31st will, no matter how many pre-orders they have by that time or whether their campaign is done or not, will get published. And each of the five authors will get some coaching from Gary Whitta, who wrote Star Wars Rogue One. He's I haven't read any of his stuff, which makes me feel super bad, but he's a well-known writer, and he seems like, what excerpts I have read, he seems very skilled, so I would love to get some of that coaching. And then from these five people, Tom and Veronica from the Sword and Laser podcast will select one book to be the first book in the Sword and Laser collection on Inkshare, and we'll give that author an interview on their podcast. So there's a lot of effort being done to really get the Inkshare platform to be well known. I got introduced to that because of Sword and Laser, and because another member of the community I'm part of, the Tadpool for Frog Pants Network, called CJ Boat, is also on Inkshare with his book. You can look up his book. It looks neat. It's a sort of fantasy sci-fi hybrid. So I find that Inkshares is, I'm not saying that, oh, this is going to replace publishers, because that's not what's going to happen. That's not, never what happens with technology. But it opens the door for people that are more serious than the, you know, the self-published artists who want to go to a vanity press, while at the same time removing the weird relationship that authors need to have with traditional publishers to get published. So it's a very exciting platform.
Well, it sounds like it'll make it a little easier for the smaller, well, I don't want to say smaller, but somebody, you know, starting out who wants to get his foot in the door to try and drum up some interest. Because once you get published, and hopefully once you start distributing, then, you know, you can get, you know, you could move on to bigger, better things if you wanted to. But it sounds like it's a way for the person with their first book to get some attention and some interest.
I'll be honest, that is the likely outcome. But I think Inkshares is more ambitious than that. I think having talked to some of the guys there, they want bestsellers. They want renowned authors to come to them to get their get their book published. Like, they want to be a genuine, you know, publisher. It's just the way they approach finding new authors is different.
Okay. Well, you know, I hear lots of things about publishing, but I don't know a whole lot about it. So I come into this with a, you know, a certain amount of self-admitted ignorance. So but, you know, anything that will encourage people to write, because I'm sure there's plenty of books out there, interesting books, you know, like this one, that need some help to get started.
Definitely. And the thing is, as a writer, you want there's so many things that stand in the way of getting your book read. If you're an illustrator, and I do some illustration, it's a lot easier to show someone that you're a good illustrator, because they can take one look at what you do, and within 15 seconds, they know whether they like what they've seen or not. Meanwhile, if you hand someone a book that's 150, 200 pages, before they know if they want to see more of your stuff, they have to spend a week, 2 weeks in their spare time sacrificing hours to digesting the material. So it's a lot harder to convince people whether or not they should give you a chance.
Well, yeah, and this way the onus is on you to show that there are at least some people interested enough to, and I suppose they figured out kind of what their minimum is to make this, I don't want to say worthwhile, but, you know, kind of justify it.
Right. I don't know if the numbers they picked is so that they can get a small profit, or is it a break-even point. I'm sure they've done the math. They seem like fairly smart people. So I'm sure that whatever numbers they chose to put there for the minimums are well thought out.
Okay.
And if they're not, they'll adjust them, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, I think maybe what we'll do at this point, if you want to give your contact info so people can find out more about, you know, where to find the book and more about you, why don't we do this now? And then I think maybe after this, and you've been warned, people, we'll go into a little spoiler section and kind of discuss the book a little bit more, because there's things in there that I found really interesting. So why don't you go ahead and give that information?
All right. So when is this podcast going out?
Well, I'll get it to Julie tonight yet, and we'll have to see how her schedule is. Hopefully, she'll get it out in the next day or so. She's usually pretty good about this. We'll just, like I say, life intervened or, you know, threw a curveball. So I think she'll try and get it out as soon as possible, because I know that there's a deadline. She knows there's a deadline to this.
Okay. I don't want to influence the way you guys do things either, because I mean, you guys have been super nice just having me. Like, before we go into the spoiler, I just want to extend my gratitude and thanks to you guys for accepting to interview me. It is super weird for me to go out to people and say, hey, could you talk to me about my book? Because that's not in my nature, but you'll understand, first of all, that this is something that's super important to me. The contest, the Inkshare campaign, to me could be a huge life changer. So it's a very humbling thing to have to go around and find people to sort of help me put the word out. So the good news is, since this is going to go out before the 31st, it will help me with my campaign and the contest. But the better news is, for your listeners and for yourselves, because I expect all three of you, Julie included, to also help me out, because it won't cost you a dime to do it. because there's a trick. And we're going to piggyback on the Sword and Laser podcast's contest for that, just because it'll give them visibility and it'll give you a free book. So basically all you need to do is you go to inkshares.com, that's inkshares.com/secrets/sword and laser, and you sign up to Inkshare from there, and then you'll get $10 credit. With that $10 credit, then you search on Inkshare for The Life Engineered, and you'll find my book. And do you guys have show notes that you can put the link in? Or
yeah, Julie will.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, put it up on our webpage. So
yeah, my reflex is you can look it up in the show notes, but this isn't my show. I can't do that.
We have it out there, so.
So right, so I'll give you guys the two links that you can put in your show notes, so it's easier for the listener. And basically, then you have $10, and you can pre-order my book from the page there. If you're feeling generous, you can toss in an extra few dollars and buy three books. And when you do that, you get your name printed in the thank you page at the end of the book, which is kind of a cool artifact. And then you have two extra books that you can give out to friends or use to as doorstops. And if you do all that before the 31st, that's when you can get the $10 credit, and that will help me get more pre-orders so I can be in that top five. I'm currently in fourth position, I believe, but it's very competitive, which I detest. I'm not good at competition, but if I'm in that top five, I will get the publishing ride, and I'll have a chance of getting interviewed on Sword and Laser and doing all that fun stuff, and you'd be realizing my dream. So again, it's inkshares.com/secrets/sword and laser.
Yeah, I've got the page up here. And so, yeah, you sign in and then you do the secret handshake or whatever, and then you get in there. And I haven't done that yet, and I'll have to, because I'm always looking for something new to consume. So, and we're always looking for material for the podcast too. So maybe we'll find some gems in there.
There's some, I mean, I don't want to pimp the competition, but once you've pre-ordered my book and after the 31st, if you guys want to use your credit to pre-order some of the other books in the sci-fi fantasy category, there's some neat stuff there. There's, I mean, none of them are as good as The Life Engineered, but some of them look almost as good, he said, trying to sound sincere.
I think you got the self-promotion thing down.
Oh, no, I suck at it. I'm terrible. This comes from 1 month of just doing it nonstop, and it's wearing on me. However, speaking of promotion, I forgot. There's a couple of cool things I'm trying to do to sort of to increase interest. So, once you go to the Inkshare campaign, you find my page there. You'll see that there's a little animation of a robot being drawn, and I've done a couple of robot drawings. Once the campaign is done, I will, like, for the rest of my days, keep on my phone a list of people that contributed. And if you find me at a convention, like I become this popular writer or whatever, or not even popular, but if you find me at a convention, I'll be at Nerdtacular this summer, and you tell me who you are and you are on my list, I will give you a signed print of one of the robots.
Well, that's awesome.
Because, you know, just as a thank you.
Well, those kinds of things are awesome. I'll have to spend some time, because I know I've heard you talking about Inkshares, and well, frankly, I've been lazy. I haven't gone to it to find out about things. And like I said, I've heard you talking about it on Sci-Fi Geeks Club. But yeah, this does sound interesting. And anything that, like I say, encourage people to get stuff out there, that's always a good thing. So,
yeah, and Inkshares isn't just sci-fi fantasy. That's just one thing they do. But they have other categories, and they have some really insanely cool looking book. There's one about war veterans that I think I'm going to get because it just looks so fascinating. They've managed to nab some very interesting books in there. I'm very optimistic about this platform.
I'm looking at stuff there, and it certainly looks, yeah, there's one here called Lebanese Cheese. The name itself, it says the hardships of war, racism, and America in the 21st century. Okay.
I thought it was a recipe book when you named it. I'm trying to remember. There's another one. I really want to find the name because it looks like such a good book. And I'm not going to find it. Well, Gary Whitta is actually has funded a book on Inkshares. He's not just doing the Sword and Laser thing. He's actually backing the entire platform. He wrote a book called Abomination that looks fascinating, and I'm eager to have a look at that. There's definitely a lot of cool things in there.
Okay. Well, okay, we've set the premise here. So I think at this point we're going to warn people. We're going to discuss the book. We'll see how far we go with this, but we're going to discuss it. There will be spoilers. You've been warned, so if you don't want to be spoiled about the book, this is where you turn off the podcast, read the book, come back, and listen to the rest of this. So, all right, you've been warned. We'll go forward here. Now, the first thing that, shocked me about the book was when we get to the part where basically the third person that's not really a human, I thought it was kind of bold that you just shot her in the head.
it's funny because in the original version of the story, you're talking about Yggdrasil, right?
Right.
Yeah, in the original, like, not in the first draft, but in my first outline of the story, I wasn't supposed to kill her. The whole point was to have her, like, sort of linger in the background and serve as a mentor. But that got boring and static as I was doing the outline. And when I finished the outline with the same thing, but when I started writing the story, I just figured, now this is going to be way more fun and interesting. And we've already got three chapters of build-up. I need something to blow up to push the action at this point. So that's why I put a gun to her head and pulled the trigger.
Well, and the reason I bring that up is because I found it fascinating when we get to the end of the book how you brought that back around and how, some of the characters were brought back into this story, and she could have gone back in, as herself. They could have rewound things, but no, she decided to let that particular iteration of her. It was of more than just of her life, but of that cycle or whatever, to keep going as it was instead of trying to go back and basically rewrite history, which they could have completely done.
The way I've got the technology figured out in my head, I don't think it'd be that easy to rewrite history because it's not a simple program. But I mean, right. In another way, it could too. It's not something that I've really explored. But I understand what you mean. Like there was no reason. I mean, it's been mentioned somewhere in the story. It is mentioned that she could have been reinserted into the artificial life, her memory wiped, and she could reunited with her child in that artificial reality, and she chooses not to. It's funny because in the end, it just made more sense to have her stay in this other reality.
Well, like I said, I found that rather interesting that, the way you just kind of brought it, back full circle from where, well, not completely full circle, because we still have those humans that are out there somewhere that disappeared into that, black hole? No, it wasn't a black hole,
It's basically, the humans have gone in the story. The humans hid in ships that they call dormitories.
Yeah.
Which at the beginning of the story, the Chapex think these are worlds, these are planets or moons where the humans are hiding. But because of the sort of paranoia that they exhibit at the beginning of the story in the prologue, they decide to hide their ships. And in the second book, we explore different other methods that they use to hide their the place where they sleep. So, but in this one, in Life Engineered, the one ship that they do find is hidden inside of a comet.
I thought that was rather interesting. Hide it in plain sight.
Yeah, because if they're doing basically the hypersleep or the cryogenic sleep thing, they're not going to be emanating much energy, so there's no infrared signature. And there's so many comets to track in the galaxy. If they make sure that no one's looking for planets, for comets in any obsessive way, then it makes them sort of safe in that sense.
Okay. Now, and like I said, the other thing that I found interesting was that, again, I can't remember the antagonist's name.
His name's Orvandil.
Okay.
Also named after a Norse god, but a... Okay. I found the name because it's the name of the morning star, and if you cross-reference that with the with Christian religion, well, Catholic religion, the morning star is Lucifer. So it's a very
layered
Byzantine way of saying that he's the bad guy.
Okay. Yeah, and the fact that, hopefully you'll get into that in your second book, too, because it sounds like he was pulled out of the nursery a wee bit early before maybe he had explored all of his personality.
Right. The whole thing, like the biggest thing that the nurseries try to weed out of Chapek personalities is the idea of self-doubt and essentially the same paranoia that drives human behavior as they hide from the galaxy as worlds are being rebuilt is one of the things that the Chapeks are trying to weed out of themselves, because it's the whole, you know, episode one Jedi thing where fear leads to anger and anger leads to suffering. As cheesy as that line is and as not as good as it should have been as that movie was, the line holds some truth that if you have a race that doesn't have any needs, doesn't have any fear, and you weed out any self-doubt, you don't have as many chances of having problems. And the moment one of these guys, one of these robots slips through the cracks and has this self-doubt, has this fear, and starts being paranoid as to why are humans hiding, what are they hiding from us, that's what makes the entire their entire civilization sort of start crumbling, because, well, things happen.
Well, I just found it kind of interesting that, you know, like I say, one, and I guess considering all the Capex that they've created, I guess one is bound to slip through, and you know, their screening process or whatever. Jeff, was there any? I've kind of dominated tonight, but was there anything that?
I think it went really well. It just every time I went to talk, there was enough lag that it just seemed like to kind of like put a hitch into the conversation, and you guys were doing fine with minimal input from me. So, no,
that sucks. I wanted to hear from my fellow Canadian.
you've done quite a book. I really enjoyed it, and I actually had a question about the. Did you do this? I'm not exactly sure what the name is, but did you start this idea as part of, is it NaNoWriMo, the writing month thing?
Yes and no. Here's the thing. Like I started writing books through NaNoWriMo about 5 years ago, a bit over 5 years ago. Someone cued me into the NaNoWriMo challenge, and I've been writing stories forever. I've been storytelling, you know, RPGs. I've tried my hand at webcomics, written short stories, like telling stories. If I look throughout my life, if there's one through line, is whatever I do, I always try to tell a story. Even in my job as a brand specialist, everything has to do with narrative. Like if I build a logo, it needs to sort of tell the company's story, which is what makes me good at my job. But at the same time, I always go back to this whole telling story thing. So I jumped on the NaNoWriMo bandwagon, and it was like a revelation. I'd written things before, but never found it. Like, I found it fun, but not that fun. But once I was writing a long-form novel, and it was, I don't know if I'm allowed swearing, you can bleep that out. I wrote a shitty vampire book as my first NaNoWriMo because I have this theory that everyone has a terrible vampire story to tell, and I said, I might as well get that piece of junk out of the way if I'm going to write more after that. And it just became an addiction. So I did NaNoWriMo 5 times since then, but always mostly for fun. There was one book that I'm probably going to revisit because I enjoyed the character and the world, but it needs a lot of polishing. And I used NaNoWriMo as a learning curve, like a school, a place where I could write as many books as I needed before I got good enough to write something fun. Now, the way I use NaNoWriMo now is because as a guy who has a full-time job and social obligations, I can't be writing, you know, 5,000 words a day. So I use NaNoWriMo as an incubator where I will once a year or twice a year take a month to do an entire first draft or as much of a first draft as I can. And then once I have that, like, all I need to do is just rewrite it five times until I have an actual good book.
Oh, only five times. Because I've written a short thing, I didn't spend that long at it, but after I got done with it, I realized this crap is hard. Not for the weak of heart, I don't think, or weak of word, anyway.
I think it's like anything. If you find something that you truly love doing, it's going to seem easy and fun to you, and someone else is going to look from outside of that and go, no, this is terrible and it's a nightmare and I don't understand why you're doing it. And I mean, I feel that way about a lot of things that people find fun, like, and I just can't understand why they find it fun. But if they do, hey, that's cool, because I've got my own stuff and variety is the spice of life.
Okay, well, yeah, that makes a certain amount of sense. Well, I think we've kind of reached, you know, a concluding point here. So you've already given your info. So I guess we'll kind of wrap up this episode of Sci-Fi Tech Talk. You can check us out at scifitechtalk.com, where there's plenty of cool space junk available for purchase, or follow us on Twitter at Sci-Fi Tech Talk. If you have any ideas or comments, please send them to scifitechtalk@gmail.com, and reviews in iTunes are always welcome. JF, if you just want to throw out, where can people contact you? You have a Twitter, Facebook, or what's your means of social interaction?
I'm starting to be, like, this campaign has forced me to be active on Twitter, so you might as well follow me there. I'm at JF Dubeau, that's JFDUBEAU. And you can also find me on Facebook at jfdubeau.writer, which is my writer page, I guess.
Okay. And do you have a web page that people can go to?
Yes, that would be the sensible place to send people, wouldn't it? Yeah, I have a webpage. It's jfdubeau.com. You'll find my books, and I have a webcomic there that's okay. And I also paint war gaming figurines and plastic soldiers. So
okay,
there's that.
All right. Jeff, where can people find you?
People can follow me on Twitter at BroncoSire. That's S-Y-E-R.
And if anybody wants to find out what I might be thinking at the moment, I'm sorry, but you can find me on Twitter at DSCChipman, or I have an about.me page at about.me/MikeMcPeak. That's MCPEEK. That's it for this show, and we'll see you in the future. Quirky matter. It's the Sci-Fi Tech Talk.